She was ripe and overripe for love. Her loneliness was a hunger so intense that it seemed it could not be assuaged, not even by those long, languid conversations under the awning of the wagon tent, when, with Shasa between them, they talked away the hottest hours of those lazy African days. Mostly they discussed the things she held dearest, music and books. Although he preferred Goethe to Victor Hugo and Wagner to Verdi, these differences gave them grounds for amusing and satisfying dispute. In those arguments she discovered that his learning and scholarship far exceeded her own, but she strangely did not resent it. It merely made her more attentive to his voice. It was a marvellous voice. After the clicking and grunting of the San language, she could listen to it, for the lilt and cadence, as though it were music in itself. "Sing for me," she ordered, when they had, for the moment, exhausted a particular topic. "Both Shasa and I command it." "Your servant, of course," he smiled, and gave them a mocking little bow. Then he sang without any self-consciousness. "Take the cheek and the hen will follow you." Santan had often heard Anna repeat the old proverb, and when she watched Shasa riding around the camp on Lothar's shoulder, she realized the wisdom behind it, for our eyes and our heart followed both of them. At first, she felt quick resentment whenever Shasa greeted Lothar with cries of "Da! Da!" That name should have been reserved for Michael alone. Then, with a painful stab, she remembered that Michael was lying in the cemetery at Mortdom. After that, it was easy to smile when Shasa's first attempts at walking, unaided on his own two legs, ended with a precipitous and headlong return to earth, and he bawled for Lothar and crawled to him, seeking comfort. It was Lothar's tenderness and gentleness with her son that nudged her affections and her need for him forward, for she recognized that beneath that handsome exterior he was a hard man and fierce. She saw the awe and respect in which his own men held him, and they were tough men themselves. Just once she witnessed him in a cold, killing rage that terrified her as much as it did the man against whom it was directed. Farkyan, the wrinkled yellow Khoisan, in indolence and ignorance, had ridden Lothar's hunting horse with an ill-fitting saddle and galled the creature's back almost to the bone. Lothar had knocked Farkyan down with a fist to the head and then cut the jacket and shirt off his back with razor strokes from his shambok, a 5-foot whip of cured hippo hide, and left him unconscious in a puddle of his own blood. The violence had appalled and frightened Santan, for she had witnessed every brutal detail from where she lay on her cot beneath the awning. Later, however, when she was alone in her shelter, her revulsion faded, and in its place was a trembly feeling of exhilaration and a heat in the pit of her stomach. "He's so dangerous," she thought, "so dangerous and cruel," and she shivered again and could not sleep. She lay and listened to his breathing in the shelter beside hers, and thought about how he must have undressed her and touched her while she was unconscious, and her flesh tingled at the memory, and she blushed in the darkness. In startling contrast, the next day he was gentle and tender, holding her injured leg in his lap while he snipped the threads of cotton and plucked them from her swollen, inflamed flesh. They left dark punctures in her skin, and he bent over her leg and sniffed the wound. "It's clean now. That redness is only your body attempting to rid itself of the stitches. It will heal swiftly now they are gone." Lothar was right. Within 2 days, she was able, with the help of the crutch he had whittled for her, to make her first foray out of the canvas shelter. "My legs feel wobbly," she protested, "and I am as weak as Shasa." "You'll soon be strong again." He placed his arm around her shoulders to steady her, and she trembled at his touch and hoped he would not notice and withdraw his arm. They paused by the horse lines, and Santan petted the animals, stroking their silky muzzles and reveling in that nostalgic horse odour. "I want to ride again," she told him. Anna Stock told me you were a skilled horsewoman. She told me you had a stallion, a white stallion. Nuage. Tears prickled her eyes as she remembered, and she pressed her face against the neck of Lothar's hunting horse to hide them. My white cloud, you were so beautiful, so strong and swift. Nuage. Lothar took her arm. A lovely name. Then he went on. Yes, you will ride again soon. We have a long journey ahead of us, back to where your father-in-law and Anna Stock will be waiting for you. It was the first time she had considered an end to this magical interlude, and she pulled away from the horse and stared at him over its back. She didn't want it to end. She didn't want him to leave her, as she knew he soon would.
I'm tired, she said. I don't think I'm ready to start riding just yet.
That evening, as she sat under the awning with a book in her lap, pretending to read, while watching him from under her lowered lids, he looked up suddenly and smiled with such a knowing glint in his eye that she blushed and looked away in confusion. "I'm writing to Colonel Courtney," he told her, sitting at the collapsible travel bureau with the pen in his hand, smiling across at her. "I will send a rider back to Windhoek tomorrow, but it will take him 2 weeks or more to get there and back. I'm letting Colonel Courtney know when and where we can meet, and I have suggested a rendezvous for the 19th day of next month." She wanted to say, "So soon?" But instead she nodded silently. "I'm sure you are most anxious to be reunited with your family, but I don't think we will be able to reach the rendezvous before that date."
"I understand."
"Avar would be delighted to send any letter that you might get to write with a messenger."
"Oh, that would be wonderful. Anna, dear Anna, she will be fussing like an old hen."
Lothar stood up from the bureau. "Please seat yourself here and use the pen and what paper you need, Mrs. Courtney. While you are busy, Master Shasa and I will see to his dinner."
Surprisingly, once she penned the opening salutation, "My dearest, dear Anna," she could think of nothing to follow it. Mere words seemed so paltry. "I give thanks to God that you survived that terrible night, and I've thought of you every day since then."
The dam holding back the words burst, and they flooded out onto the paper. "We will need a pack horse to carry that epistle." Lothar stood behind her shoulder, and she started as she realized that she had covered a dozen sheets with close script.
"There is so much still to tell her, but the rest will have to wait."
Santerne folded the sheets and sealed them with a wax wafer from the silver box fitted into the top of the bureau while Lothar held the candle for her.
"It was strange," she whispered. "I had almost forgotten how to hold a pen. It has been so long."
"You have never told me what happened to you. How you escaped from the sinking ship, how you survived so long, how you came to be so many hundreds of miles from the coast, where you must have come ashore."
"I don't want to talk about it,"
she cut him off quickly. She saw for a moment in her mind's eye the little heart-shaped, wrinkled, amber-coloured faces, and suppressed her nagging guilt at having deserted them so cruelly.
"I don't even want to think about that. Kindly never address the subject again, sir."
Her tone was stingingly severe. "Of course, Mrs. Courtney." He picked up the two sealed letters. "If you will excuse me, I will give these to Farkyan now. You can leave before dawn tomorrow." He was stiff-faced and resentful of the rebuff. She watched him cross to the servants' fire and heard the murmur of voices as he gave Farkyan his orders. When he returned to the shelter, she made a pretense of being engrossed with her book, hoping that he would interrupt her, but he seated himself at the bureau and opened his journal. It was his nightly ritual, his entry in the leather-bound journal. She listened to his pen scratching on the paper, and she resented his attention being focused anywhere but on herself.
"There is so little time left to us," she thought, "and he squanders it so."
She closed her book loudly, but he did not look up.
"What are you writing?" she demanded. You know what I'm writing, since we have discussed it before, Mrs. Courtney. Do you write everything in your journal? Almost everything. Do you write about me? He laid down the pen and stared at her, and she was flustered by the direct gaze of those serene, yellow eyes, but could not bring herself to apologize. You were prying into things that did not concern you, she told him. Yes, he agreed with her. And to cover her discomfort, she demanded, What have you written about me in your famous journal? And now, madam, it is you who are inquisitive, he told her as he closed his diary, placed it in the drawer of the bureau, and stood up. If you will excuse me, I must make my rounds of the camp.